Please join me at Numbers chapter 6, and I want to just start at verse number 1. I'm not going to make commentary on all of this, but I do want us to rehear the Nazirite vow particulars before we start talking about how it is terminated. It says, "He who is spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazirite." A Nazirite means somebody who's unshorn, uncut. "To separate himself to he who is. He shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes fresh or dried. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, nor even the seeds or the skins." So, first thing that they have to swear off is anything alcoholic and anything related to the grapes. Verse 5, "All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head until the time is completed for which he separates himself to he who is. He shall be holy. He shall let the locks of his hair of his head grow long." Second particular for the Nazirite vow is no cutting of the hair or beard. Verse 6, "All the days that he separates himself to he who is, he shall not go near a dead body, not even for his father or for his mother. For brother or sister, if they die, shall he make himself unclean," because his separation to God is on his head. "All the days of his separation, he is holy to he who is." And that's the third one. The people under a Nazirite vow do not touch dead bodies, do not go to funerals, do not help with funeral preparations, even for close family members, because that's off limits. And I shared with you that when we look at these things, and even some of the verbiage there, it is similar to what is required of priests during their 7-8 day ordination service. They're not supposed to be drinking. They're not supposed to be touching any dead bodies, even close family members. And I think just by practicality, they don't do any haircuts while they're going through that 8-day ceremony. So the Nazirite vow is basically an individual voluntarily, most of the time, saying, "I want to devote myself to the work of God, to the ministry of God." Now, people can do it voluntarily for a limited amount of time. The Apostle Paul seems to be one that does that. But there are several instances where it is placed upon the person before they were even born, such as John the Immerser, Samuel the prophet, Samson the judge. And that's the reason, by the way, that Samson had very long hair put in 7 locks, 7 braids, is because he'd spent his entire life up to that point not cutting his hair. So that's the Nazirite vow. Here is some of the possibilities of bringing that vow to a conclusion. Verse number 9. "If any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head." So this is going to be a rarity. The Nazirite might be standing right next to a guy that has a massive coronary, keels over, and touches him. And immediately, his vow has been broken. It was an accident, yes. Doesn't matter. He's touched a dead body, or I suppose we might even say a dead body touched him. And so he has defiled his consecrated head, because the uncut hair becomes the terminology for the Nazirite vow. because Nazare means untrimmed. So if that happens, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. So he's like, all right, my Nazarite vow has just been negated, so I'm cutting my hair off. And then on the seventh day, he shall shave it. So it's shave it once, and then you shave it again. On the eighth day, that's interesting. We're back to the priesthood thing, aren't we? On the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the priest shall offer one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him because he sinned by reason of the dead body. Now, he didn't do it on purpose. It was an accident. But his vow was negatively impacted. And so he has to make things right. He shall consecrate his head that same day and separate himself to he who is for the days of his separation, and then bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering, but the previous period shall be void because his separation was defiled. Now that last little part tells us that the expectation was that when a person took a Nazarite vow, they took it for a specific period of time. Maybe they would say for a month, or 2 months, or half of a year, or an entire year. Or in the case of the Apostle Paul, maybe until I prepare to head back to the Holy Land after my missionary journey is complete. But whatever it is, they had something in mind as the termination point. And if they don't make it to the termination point before something happens that defiles them, then it's a reset. They didn't make it, and so they have to start over again to complete their vow, because they did make a promise, and the promise has to be kept. And so that is the rule regarding accidentally having your vow terminated. Now, what happens if you finish the term? Verse 13, this is the law for the Nazarite when the time of his separation has been completed. He shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall bring his gift to he who is, one male lamb a year old without blemish for a burnt offering, one ewe lamb a year old without blemish as a sin offering, one ram without blemish as a peace offering. And remember, we went over at the beginning of the book of Leviticus these five different types of offerings, sacrifices. And so here are three specific ones mentioned here. And a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offerings and their drink offerings. So now we've got four of the five. And the priest shall bring them before he who is, and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering, and he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to he who is with the basket of unleavened bread. And the priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. Now let's go back to the Apostle Paul on this. It would appear that when the Apostle had finished his third missionary journey, he had completed the term of his Nazarite vow, and so he was no longer bound by the conditions of his vow, so he went ahead and shaved his head. I think it was at Kenchrea, which was the south port servicing the city of Corinth. He was getting ready to head back to Jerusalem to complete the ritual portion of his vow. But he shaved his head and probably kept the hair because he was going to burn that once he arrived in Jerusalem. Verse 19. The priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled and one unleavened loaf out of the basket, one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazirite after he shaved the hair of his consecration. So what we're seeing here described is the procedure that the apostle and his companions that he was paying for were going through once James and the other leaders of the church of Jerusalem came to the Apostle Paul and said, hey, look, there's this rumor flying around that you don't believe that Jewish people should do Jewish things. You want them to all become Gentiles, which was not true. Paul was only saying, hey, Gentiles can't be forced to become Jewish in order to be saved. He wasn't saying Jewish people need to quit being Jewish. James and the others said, look, we know you're finishing up your Nazirite vow. We've got some other guys that are finishing up their Nazirite vow. Why don't you take them along with you into the temple to do the procedures together, and you foot the bill? And Paul was like, I'm all over that. Now, he didn't get through the whole ceremony because of the riot and getting arrested and all that. But that's a story for another day. The Nazirite's supposed to take all these things into his hands, and the priest, verse 20, shall wave them for a wave offering before he who is. They are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed. Remember, the priest gets certain parts of sacrifices. And so the chest portion belongs to him. The right thigh belongs to him. And then once all of these procedures have been finished, after that, the Nazirite may drink wine. So now he can also go to funerals. He's cut his hair. He's finished his vow. And so he is now allowed to go back to normal Jewish lifestyle. Verse 21. This is the law of the Nazirite. But if he vows an offering to he who is above his Nazirite vow, so if he, part of his vow was, and when I'm done, I'm going to give such and such things in addition to the vow completion sacrifices. So this would be a voluntary sacrifice. So if he's done that, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazirite. Now, because we're talking about vows here in Numbers chapter 6, this is a good time to go back and grab a hold of the vow section that is in the book of Leviticus, the rule book for Levites. Chapter 27 is the vow section. And it has some specific things for the Jewish people to know. One of them is how to evaluate how much a person is worth work-wise if you are calculating giving to the Lord an equivalent amount of that work product in cash or in precious metals. And so that's where we start in Leviticus 27. He who is spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, if anyone makes a special vow to he who is involving the valuation of persons. So basically, I am going to give to the Lord the equivalent of a year's salary for myself, for my wife, for my son, for my daughter, for my servant, whoever it is. Then you have to have a way of putting a monetary value on that. And this is the formula for figuring that out. And it's not talking about the intrinsic value of the person, because everyone is equal in the eyes of God. Everyone is precious in his sight. What is being portrayed in these valuations we're about to see is potential work product based on musculature. And the reality is, in general terms, a male tends to be larger and more muscular than a woman of the same age. That's just the way it works. And so they take that into consideration in these valuations. Remember, it's God that's giving all this information. A younger person does not have as much muscular tone and therefore can't do as much work. An older person who has started to lose muscle tone cannot do as much work, because this is physical work that is typically being valued here. And so that's the reason for the differentials that we're about to read. It says, verse 3, then the valuation of a male from 20 years old up to 60, so 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, shall be 50 shekels of silver according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Now, this is before coinage, long before coinage, so it is a measure of weight. But over time, the weight of silver, known as a shekel, did turn into a coin and did have an assigned value of roughly 2 days' wages. So in this case, we're talking about 100 days' wages is what is being portrayed as the value of this man in his peak years of physical activity. Now, if a woman is a female, if a person is a female, the valuation shall be 30 shekels, or roughly 60 days' wages. If the person is from 5 years old up to 20 years old, so a young person, then the valuation shall be for a male 20 shekels, 40 days' wages, and for a female 10 shekels, or 20 days' wages. If the person is from a month old up to 5 years old, so a baby up through a kindergartner, the valuation for a male is 5 shekels, 10 days' wages, and for a female, the valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver, or 6 days' wages. If the person is 60 years old or over, and that's the framework where I fall in here, it shall be 15 shekels. So not even as much as what a teenager is worth, correct? Because of muscle power issues here. So 30 days' wages, and for a female, 10 shekels or 20 days' wages. Now, if we've got an issue here where the person, maybe there's something going on where they just, they're not part of the normal valuation process. If someone is too poor to pay a valuation, so he can't afford to kick in what his situation would really require, then he shall be made to stand before the priest, and the priest shall value him, and the priest shall value him according to what the vower can afford. So it's a case-by-case basis. If the person is poor but made a vow and is now trying to, shall we say, cash out on that vow. Now, what if the vow is an animal? How could that happen? Well, suppose a person raises cattle, and one of his cows is pregnant, and he says, I want to give this baby cow that's going to be born later this year to God. All right? Verse number 9, if the vow is an animal that may be offered as an offering to he who is, all of it that he gives to he who is holy. So he vows the vow, this baby cow, I'm given to the Lord as a sacrifice. And when the baby cow is born, verse 10, he shall not exchange it or make a substitute for it, good or bad for good. So the baby is born and he can't go, oh, boy, that's a good looking little calf. I don't think I want that to get burned up. He can't redeem it. However, there is a possibility of substituting something for it if he looks at it as a righteous person and goes, oh, that's not good enough for God. There's a problem with that animal. I don't want to give God something like that. He can substitute a better animal in its place. Let's read. If he does, in fact, substitute one animal for another, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. So he doesn't get to keep the animal that was born just because he didn't think it was good enough for God. He gives it to God anyway. But his substitute is counted as holy in its place. And by the way, that principle becomes important in a story in the book of Judges later, where you can substitute something different than what you vowed if you don't think it's appropriate to what you vowed it for, but the thing you vowed still belongs to God. There is a judge named Jephthah who unthinkingly, and that's part of the problem with vows, is sometimes you don't think through what you're saying. He vowed that the first living thing that he saw when he arrived at his property would belong to God as a sacrifice. And his virgin daughter, the only child he had, heard about daddy coming home and went way far away from the homestead and met dad. And dad was now on the hook. Now, some people have got the very foolish notion that Jephthah had to sacrifice her. No, the Israelites did not practice human sacrifice. That would be an atrocity. It would be an aberration. It would be an abhorrent thing to the Lord. But while he could give an appropriate animal in substitute for his daughter, the daughter still belonged to God. And so that's why in the story that we'll come to later, Jephthah's daughter grieved for a month with her companions over her virginity, because she'd never be able to get married and never be able to have kids, and therefore her family line was coming to an end because of her father's vow. And so I'll remind you of this vow when we get to that story later. Verse 11, Leviticus 27. If there is in any unclean animal that may not be offered as an offering to he who is, then he shall stand the animal before the priest, and the priest shall value it as either good or bad, as the priest values it, so it shall be. But if he wishes to redeem it, he shall add a fifth to the valuation. So somehow the guy vows that maybe the next animal that he sees in his property belongs to God, and it happens to be a donkey. Well, a donkey can't be offered as a sacrifice, but it now belongs to the priesthood because he promised it to God. Apparently, though, he can redeem a non-sacrificial animal back as long as he pays 120% of its value to the priests. Verse 14. When a man dedicates his house as a holy gift to he who is, the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so it shall stand. If the donor wishes to redeem his house, he shall add a fifth to the valuation price, and it shall be his. So a person could say, you know, I want to give this house that belongs to me to the Lord. Well, that's fine until maybe one of his kids wants the house to live in, and then the guy might want it back. And after all, it is part of his inheritance by right. It would come back to him in the end of the the Jubilee cycle anyway. But in this case, God says, if he wants to kick in 120% of the value of that place to the priesthood, then yes, he can redeem it. Same thing for property as in land. If a man dedicates to he who is part of the land that is his possession, say a field, a grain field, or a vineyard, then the valuation shall be in proportion to its seed or its product. A homer of barley seeds, which that's just a measurement. It's a big measurement. It's like 6 bushels worth. So a homer of barley seed shall be valued at 50 shekels of silver. If he dedicates his field from the year of Jubilee. So remember, the year of Jubilee is the 50th year of a 50-year cycle. It's also the first year of the next 50-year cycle. And it's the starting point for land leases. So if he dedicates his field to the use of the priests at the second year of this next cycle, the year after the year of Jubilee, then the valuation shall stand. But if he dedicates his field after the Jubilee, then the priest shall calculate the price according to the years that remained until the Jubilee, basically proration. The deduction shall be made from the valuation. And if he has dedicated the field and he wishes to redeem it, he's going to add, guess what? A fifth, 20%, to its valuation price for it to remain his. So 120% is the normal redemption rate for anything that you want to take back under your control. We're out of time. Mark your place. We'll be back to some more vows next time we're into the Word.